This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Let me introduce myself. I'm Steve Hirons. I've actually recently been promoted to director, but I still reside in the Department of Earth Sciences where I do a lot of teaching. For those that don't know Birkbeck, we specialise in doing part-time degrees to mature students, so it's evening study. They come at 6 o'clock till 9 o'clock, and the degree is spread over 4 years. So our average age range is about 35 years old, but some students are young as, I say young, 20, some 65, 70. So we've got a very broad spectrum, both in age and academic ability. We do find some people are retired from academia and come and study geology because it's been something in their life for a long, long time, passion, and they haven't been able to develop it. So I'm going to talk about teaching and learning, how that's influenced retention. But of course, teaching and learning probably has many different connotations for us. So I'm just going to ask you a minute to reflect on what teaching and learning means to you and your institution, methods you use, how they're applied, etc. So just because I might ask questions in a minute. So anyone going to give me an idea of what their perception of teaching and learning is?
To go back to your early question, I'm actively engaged in learning as a student, if that counts, but I'm yet to teach. Teaching and learning for us at Lincoln is intrinsically linked to research. We have an ethos of research-engaged teaching at an undergraduate level now that we're trying to spread across the institution. So for us it's really important that it's based on cutting-edge research, and that if you're teaching, you're also researching and sharing that. So the process of teaching is engaging as a partner with the student to discover knowledge together, and using research to learn and to teach.
Okay. I just ask, is that discipline-centred research or pedagogic-centred research? Is it research and pedagogy, or is it research within the discipline?
Mm. Discipline.
Yeah. It generally is going to be discipline, isn't it?
It's generation of new knowledge and new understandings.
Okay.
Our core business of the university.
And it's about sharing knowledge and learning together too. And Mike touched on the idea of being a community of learners. And I think that the teachers and the learners, they're kind of artificial titles because you are learning together in the process.
Okay. Good.
Preparation for life.
Yeah, okay. How do most of us or most institutions go about delivering those ideas? I'll put a slide up because I think it's pertinent to most of us. So a lot of undergraduate teaching is still through lectures. I think they're the core way of imparting information. Obviously, with large student groups now, tutorials and seminars are probably as effective, if not more. And then we've got a range of other ways, depending on the type of course. Obviously, for a science course, where we have lots of laboratory work, practicals, we do a lot of problem-based learning, etc., etc. So I don't think there's any surprise. We're not doing anything new here, but it's just having a range of tools and techniques for sharing information, building knowledge, building confidence, and trying to get our students to be independent thinkers.
Can I ask you, why you think lecturers remain the core teaching method when there are all these other methods that are being used by members of staff? Not as you might imply, with any great depth or widespreadness across the institution, but why do lectures remain the core teaching method when we know so much about how students learn in lectures?
Do you know?
Or rather, they don't.
Yeah. I think there's a cultural change, a massive cultural change that has to go on in a lot of universities. And when I did some teacher training when I started, I was terrified of going into a department that had established methods for delivering information, and that was the lecture style. And the chap who was leading this course, I had a chat with him. I said, look, I'm not happy about this. How do we go about it. And he was within the institution, so he knew the staff of my department. He said, well, Steve, it's quite simple. You negotiate. And that empowered me to talk to the head of the department and say, look, I want to try some new things. And they said, yeah, go ahead. It's your responsibility. And that empowerment has been with me all through my teaching career. And I still go back to that because it's really important to me. I suppose it's to deal with large numbers. The perception is the lecturer is the best approach. I'm not absolutely convinced. And I've actually changed a lot of processes in our department to try and get away from some of those issues.
Yeah, I mean, if people had or were aware of the research, this is why I asked the question about pedagogic research rather than discipline-based research, a lot of people would begin to realise that if you get more and more students in those kinds of arenas, that the lecture method is not necessarily the greatest way of educating people.
Absolutely.
Leaving aside whether one feels that education is about delivering information to people, I'm not so certain that it is. So it's a question of how you shift that culture. I appreciate that empowerment, obviously, and being given that blessing by somebody to do that is terribly important. And you won't always find that in institutions that senior managers will allow that.
Yeah.
I think it's important not to underestimate the power of that 800 years of practice has on practice traditions.
Yeah.
We all have inherited something from our own education experiences as well.
Sure.
So we're all used to having been lectured.
Mm-hmm.
So we come into the profession thinking, this is the way that HE is done.
And that's what makes me a student. When you're aspiring from school to be an undergraduate student, yes, that's the way it's done. I want to be in those big lecture
theatres. But I think, teaching and learning is experiential. And I certainly dare, and I guess some of you will remember, the old days when I was an undergraduate and you went into your lecture and the lecturer stood there and scribbled everything out and you copied the notes verbatim. That was how I was lectured and taught. I want to get away from that. That's terrible. And hopefully not many students have to suffer that anymore.
Do you think universities define themselves by their campus? That they need a campus which is impressive and you've got to fill the campus with something. So you fill it with sort of impressive lecture theatres, because on open days, people are showing around, aren't they? Look, this is our 200-seater lecture theatre, and there's a projector there, and there's a screen there, and everything, and the seats are comfortable, etc. There's Wi-Fi. There's nothing to show people, is there, if there's all sort of small cubby holes that the people break
but
into.
You can do it virtually now, can't you? Do it that way.
But it looks more like school, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because
you need an edifice, don't you? You need some sort of statement which is physical.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I'm not saying you need that. But I mean, sort of like the mentality of universities is that it's got to be there. It's got to be a grand building or sort of like a nice looking building.
Well, I wish, because where I work is they're not smart classrooms by any means, and the department's pretty old. So
I think it's important also not to throw the baby out of the bathwater in the sense that there is a role for the lecture as an education format. It's just that it's overused, massively overused, and used in contexts where it shouldn't be. But lectures can be inspirational. You shouldn't forget that.
Well, they
can be a very effective method for relaying the results, for instance, of cutting-edge research.
But the term lecture is value-laden, isn't it? It's sort of, I'm going to lecture you now. Doesn't mean I want to hear from you.
It doesn't mean there's an interaction.
Exactly, but it can be interactive as well. And some of the best lectures that I've been to have been truly interactive.
I think the worst thing for a lecturer is to stand in front of a group and see the heads nodding. And if that happens, I shouldn't confess to this, but I feel that I'm not doing my job properly. Lectures have to, whether you agree with the structure of them or not, they have to be engaging. And with the comments that have been made today earlier about professionalisation of academic teaching staff, I would hope that, the enthusiasm and the passion for passing on the knowledge would actually be taken into account.
Sorry, just playing the devil's advocate a little bit in relation to the old lecture style of the lecturer standing up front, writing on the OHP and the students copying that down. I'd argue that actually that worked better for me as a student because there was the engagement in taking it in terms of through listening, but also through activity. And the fact that we've shifted now to a place where the slides are available and delivered to the students, and the students are not encouraged to kind of write anything in relation to those slides for, in some circumstances, that is worse than what was there before.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I start my lecture modules, I do two modules after Christmas. I go through learning styles with them and I tell them how to embed knowledge into their deep memory. Some people listen, some don't.
So. Yeah, they're still just disengaged. They may listen, but they...
Yeah. Okay, so that's quite interesting. Let's. What I'd like to do is talk about some of the things that I do, and I'll show you some graphs near the end that have impacted on retention. So it's about our student community. We do face-to-face teaching in the evening. We lecture for about an hour. Students go for a tea break, and then there's an hour and a half practical, because geology is a very practical subject. But we've also got all our materials online, so we have distance learners. And those distance learners can be what you would probably call traditional distance learners in a different country, a different part of Europe, or they may be in America or wherever. But we also have what we call distance learners in the UK that just might live in Nottingham or Leicester but can't come to us. And we also have blended learners. So because all the materials are available online, they can make a decision that the work pressures are too much, they're not going to come in tonight, and they will address their learning that way. We also, for our sins, video all our lectures and make them available. For this year, I've made them available on mobile devices so that people that are commuting can actually watch the videos on their little MP3, MP4s or whatever as they're coming into work, going home. Or so it makes... not mobile learning as such, but flexibility is the key point for me for our students. Basically because of they're doing this in their own time. Most of them are paying for themselves. They're keeping a job. They've got domestic issues to deal with. So, you know, it's a hard way of doing it. And I want to make it as easy as possible. And this sort of access to materials does that. Yeah, okay. So one of the things, I don't think necessarily the teaching methods have changed so much, but what has changed in university is the huge uptake of degree places by students. So we've got massively more students to deal with. And these figures are a little bit old, they go back to 2007, but you can see now that we've actually geared up to universities being businesses, big multi-million pound businesses. I think that's accepted now. But as teachers, facilitators of learning, I don't think we've actually cottoned on to the fact that actually we've got a major role to play in that as entrepreneurs. And I think that's the next step for us to develop, or one of the next steps. I think there's lots of steps, but it's one of the next steps for us as sort of academic teachers to take on board. But what we still need to do are these three, well, I find these three key to my teaching and my curriculum design. Have to engage the students, we've got to motivate them, enthusiasm them. Most of all, you've got to retain them. And there's lots of studies going on, particularly at first year undergraduate level, of student retention. Whether there's a big dropout from the first term to the second term, how we look at those figures and what it means in terms of the institutional finances and what it means in terms of the student learning experience.
Can I just say something about that?
Yeah.
You're dealing mostly with part-time mature students.
Yep.
In my own experience, I spent 15 years working in the CE department. My own experience is that motivation wasn't a problem. The students had to be motivated to be there on a cold January evening after a long day at work. And when retention became a problem, it was largely due to factors that were completely beyond our control. Things like problems at work, problems at home. So retention, although we did lose a certain proportion of students, it was normally through factors we had no influence over. Is that the case here? Or?
Generally, yes. But we're not just dealing with face-to-face students. We are dealing with the distance learners as well. So
you get a higher dropout rate amongst your online distance learners?
I think it's about an equal split. We're doing quite well, actually.
I mean, I can see why retention is important. I mean, that's obvious. But there are people who genuinely have come on the wrong course. And you always sort of see a drop-off in everything, you know. A new series on TV starts, high numbers, it drops off. You know, there's a loss, you know, sort of like in everything, really.
Well,
it's unrealistic to think, well, 100 people signed up for this, so 100 people have to finish. Because
I totally agree with you.
It doesn't really respect people, you know, where they are at particular times. And, you know, just looking at module titles, you can't really tell what sort of like, you know, the subject is about. And I think people do find other avenues to go down quite genuinely.
Yeah. My interpretation of the statistics is that if people are dropping out because they're on the wrong programme, it's normally within the first 4 weeks of term. And I don't know about all of you, but we still try and interview all our students to make sure they've got the right information. So I think there's this sort of community, we have a responsibility to ensure that they are doing the right course for the right reasons. And we don't have a great deal of dropout because of that, like you were saying. But we have dropout due to domestic, due to work-related problems, being promoted, etc. So a different kind of set, but common to part-time students, I think.
Yeah, the interviewing question is an interesting one. I'm not sure routine interviewing with undergraduate students is a reality in many schools of study, many universities.
Yeah, I can't say it's... We may have to revisit it because our student numbers are growing year on year now, so we may have to look at that and say, well, it's no longer feasible. But, you know, I think that's an important part of the relationship. And for us, anyway, it definitely works. OK. Yeah, classification, etc., we sort of looked at that. I'm just wondering how business will take over the education model when we start looking at cost effectiveness of teaching. Should we be doing certain amount of hours and then handing over to postgrads? All that problem. Don't want to go there yet, but I'm just putting my head in the sand. I'm sure it will come. So we are due for a big shake-up, I'm sure. Delivery. I think that's the main thing that has changed, certainly while I've been teaching. And it's gone down this route of technology-enhanced learning. And I know some of you are practitioners of this. You embed it in your curriculum. And for most of our students, it seems to be what they want, unless we dig too deeply, I think. Okay. So we tell ourselves one of the primary drivers about using TEL is enhancing the quality of the teaching and learning. We say it's a student expectation these days. They need this, they expect it. If we don't provide, they may go elsewhere. But also it's improving access off campus. And I think for our type of student, our mature part-time student, that's essential, that level of flexibility. I talk about it at open evenings. I talk about it when I interview students, and they say that having the course notes online, having the videos online, being able to access staff online is one of the a combination of reasons that they come to us. And I suppose, you know, these people are paying good money. Most of them are paying for themselves, so they've got a fair point. But I think technology-enhanced learning depends on where you're coming from, whether you're a student, whether you're an academic or a technologist. You're all going to have different views of this. But essentially, it ends up with the virtual learning environment. Now, whether you think they're useful, whether they're prescriptive, whether they should be dead. There was a good debate not too long ago by GIST about that. But the virtual learning environment for us is a necessary evil or a necessary tool, and we do use it as essentially, as an electronic repository. If you've got champions within the department who foster technology, develop technology, they become trusted. And I'm that, I'm either the GFI that we were talking about earlier, or the champion. And staff now trust me with my suggestions about technology. We were in a fortunate or unfortunate position many years ago whereby we had one of those trigger points that Julie was talking about earlier. And those trigger points were developed out of crisis. And we were in a crisis, actually. In the late 80s, 90s, we relied on a lot of oil companies to send us their TAs to be trained up through degree programs and MSc programs. And we were fairly complacent about having this resource. Excuse the pun, but that resource dried up and the oil companies moved out of London, or a lot of them did, up to Aberdeen, etc. And our pool of students dried up. And we were left in a position where we possibly had 10 undergraduates per year, which is not feasible. That was terrible. You think about 10 students over 4 years, not good. And that's out of that crisis came distance learning. And that distance learning was where we put all our materials into electronic format. And we've now benefited from that greatly. Student numbers have grown. We're a model within our university. So we're very happy with that crisis. But it did take a crisis to change things. OK, I'm going to move on quite quickly. But I think the danger in using technology is this... the technological tail wagging the pedagogic dog. We've got to be careful how we use it. And I think the question to ask yourself is it technology driving innovation, or is it innovation driving the technology? And how we harness that technology in a pedagogic way. I think, you know, that's crucial to any design program. Yeah, this may be a bit arrogant, but... we not only have to look after the academic advancement, we have to look at the digital literacy of our students. Having said that, a lot of our mature students have got better expertise than I have with some of the digital side of it, so you have to be really careful. This is how we use our VLEs Blackboard at the moment. We're going to change across to Moodle, but Blackboard, Moodle are the most popular VLEs, and we use it for these reasons.
Why you're moving from Blackboard?
This is on camera, but cost, really.
Right, okay, fair enough.
Essentially, they're very similar in functionality. Our license is coming up.
A Moodle is open.
Open source,
isn't it?
Yeah.
This Blackboard is tied down.
That's right, yeah. So as long as the functionality is reasonable, I may change my mind in 6 months and tell you that it wasn't a good move. I don't know. But that's what's going to happen. So, yeah, we do all this sort of stuff with our students, make all that material available. What I'd like to do is just show you some of our material so you get an indication of what's going on. So most of our learning materials are done in PDF format. So if I could ask Ben just to give a click on that. Top one. That's it, thanks. So these are maybe... we find this very useful. All our lecture material is like this, in this sort of format, so it's across the curriculum. You can click on those yellow boxes and they expand. I can go to the next page. Can you go to the next page there, Ben? Just click on it, it should go... Oh, I've got it. And can you click on that picture? This is what we call a thin section. It's a rock that you grind down and pass light through, and you can see the minerals. And the students should be able to identify those minerals. I don't know if that video works. So we embed videos. That should rotate, but never mind. We embed videos within our PDFs. We embed audio within them. I knew I should have used my Mac. But never mind. There you go. So students get to recognise these minerals and the properties, etc. So it is a multimedia-rich presentation for them. don't know where we go now. Bit of both, actually, bit of both. When this first came up, this is a thing that most of us have kind of touched on today, that to have creative time is essential. Hands up who gets creative time anymore. You know, this happened for me. It was an amalgamation of, it wasn't just a crisis, it was a massive crisis. But a member of staff left, and it allowed me to take a little bit, not a sabbatical or anything, but just a little bit of critical thinking time. That's where this distance learning and this whole concept came from. My feet haven't touched the ground since. But, you know, I think it's, you know, to progress ideas, you've got to have that time, and we just don't anymore. So, yeah, very good question.
What worried me a few weeks ago was to have a presentation from Pearson, who are selling the content to universities, and that the actual content just looks like a kind of textbook for online. It's not as lovely as this. But you could imagine them selling or attempting to sell to universities, you know, here's a geology undergraduate programme, here's a module on a module on this. And it worries me that that will be the option for some places. If they don't give people like you the time, they'll think that they can buy something off the peg, which won't be as lovely as this. You know, but then from the student's perspective, they've got every lecture note, it's all quite basic stuff, but it's kind of there. So yeah. I think we're really at a difficult time where it could go either way.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I think they always have. I mean, in terms of textbooks.
I suppose, yeah. It's only the next stage up, isn't it? It becomes e-learning now, but it's still just textbook, yeah. I think you're right, yeah.
I was just thinking, you know, as higher education goes global and global markets become increasingly important for all institutions here in the UK, all universities are going to have to figure out what kind of strategy they want to adopt.
Absolutely, yeah.
In terms of e-learning, we're in the same position at the moment. But it seems to me, if you're going to go down the e-learning route, you really need to resource it properly. And I was wondering, you know, how many technologists do you have? I mean, it sounds like you've got quite a big team behind there, working partnerships with the academics.
I started this off on my own. Everyone agreed it was a good idea. Go on, get on with it, Steve. We'll sign up to it if we know it's successful. You know, that was how it started off. I got some pump priming money from the university. And when people began to see... The question was, what can it do for me? People were asking that when we came up with it. And actually, I heard that same question not long ago. Why should I do it? What's in it for me? And I was doing a presentation like this to some of our staff, and somebody in the maths department said, brilliant, Steve, really like it, but what if you haven't got any content to put on VLE?
Great question.
I was... I was quite shocked.
Yeah.
And actually, we have been, there's some sort of issue about the levels of using the VLE across the college. So our department, 100%, some of the arts departments, 10%. You know, there is a disparity of usage across a college.
And that then raises issues of comparability.
Yeah. Absolutely, equity. Yeah. So we've got all those issues going on at the moment. Mm. The only thing about... putting our videos and videos of the lectures in the VLE is it's kind of a closed source, and that's a safe environment.
So only the students registered on that module can access the
video. Yeah. And we have no problems with, you know, copyright or IPR or anything like that in that context. I don't know if you can close. Can you just... That's it, thanks. This next one, the live internet resource... We use Google Earth. I don't know if you're familiar with that, sometimes for teaching. This, I was using this in my first year teaching, talking about plate tectonics. And it's a lovely thing. You can see we haven't got smart classrooms.
The round shape, some topography on these.
So these are small volcanoes associated with what we call a subduction zone. Can you stop that now, Ben? Okay. Anyway, the nice thing about this, I was using this live in the lecture, and at the end of the lecture, I went to the United States Geological Survey site where they monitor earthquakes, And some of the areas we'd visited on Google Earth had had earthquakes that night. It was like, wow. It was really bringing geology alive to the students.
You caused it.
Yeah, probably.
That yeah.
And it was a strike. Yeah, it's that stick thing, isn't it? Right.
And what, again now.
Yeah, hold my hands up, I'm responsible. One of the other things that I found really interesting, again, it came to, I had a lecture for first years. We had 65 students in the lecture theatre, and we were talking about compasses to use on geological maps, interpretations, directions, all this. And I did ask the basic question, does everybody know how to use a compass? And everyone was nodding, yes, yes, yes. And when we came to the practical, it was quite obvious some of them didn't. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't they put their hands up? And it was obviously an embarrassment factor. So this video cast, as I call it, is just a small one or two-minute introduction to a compass. So if we can just do part of this, not too long. And this overcame any embarrassment about, Steve, I don't know how to do it. And it's, you know, these video casts, and I think you use a lot of video casts.
So here we have a typical compass. Around the outside, we've got a series of numbers. This is called a bezel, and we've got numbers from 0 all the way round to 360. Superimposed on this, we've got north, east, south, and west. And the way I remember this is never eat shredded wheat. And that'll help you when you're doing your map work later on. Also,
so, you know, you've got to be on the ground to see what the students' perception is and what their worries are, but I thought that was a great way of addressing an issue. And, you know, no one knows that they go and look at... Well, they don't know that no one knows that they're looking at it and stuff, but obviously in Blackboard or possibly Moodle, you can actually see access statistics. You'll be surprised. Well, actually, I think there's an issue with,
shredded.
Yeah, with perhaps they don't even know what shredded wheat is. That's the worrying thing. But I think with people with dyslexia or things like that, it's quite good. I'll not go into the other two, but one is about using wikis, and again, this was an idea that I developed. It's probably not the traditional way of using wikis, but those thin sections that you saw rotating earlier on, they form quite a large part. So I put pictures up on this wiki and I get the distance learners to interact with the face-to-face students, and it's a good way of avoiding the isolation. And the students are really keen on that, so I'm quite pleased with that development.
Is there a BLE-based wiki?
Yeah. Okay. This is great. You can also have fun with these video casts. So this is part of a practical where we're trying to make the students think about lava from volcanoes and the viscosity of the lava and the heat of the lava will change, and the speed that they run down the mountainside changes. So we were just doing a practical here. If we do a video... So I don't know whether it was making the mess that the students loved or, but you can see you can use it in a fun way as well. And actually, one of our distance learners went off on a tangent on, thought this was brilliant. He said, well, if you put 1001 bits in there, it's going to change the flow rates and the turbulence. And wow, it was great. It just inspired some extra thoughts. It's brilliant. Okay, I think for us, we need to think about the provision of our materials and what it means to the student. How does it engage them? How do they learn from this? Where do they learn from this? Is it really a flexible resource? And my course, this is access to the PDF type data that you saw at the beginning. Guess which day my course is run? Yep, on a Wednesday. Okay. And these are the sort of hours that our students are logging in to download information. There's normally a peak at sort of late afternoon, lunchtime-ish.
You can tell that they're mature students because there's nothing up the mid.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then that lecture is videoed and the video is made available the following day. And you can see there that there's a good proportion of students go on Thursday to look at the videos.
Did you have to counter an argument amongst your colleagues that people would stop coming if the lectures were
Well, this is what people say to me, you know, we put registers out, why don't you? And we say, well, we do, but if we've got people that are learning via the blended route, or they've decided they can't come in for the next 2 weeks, but they're going to use this for our distance learners. So I think I'm privileged that our students are mature students, and just because they're not coming in doesn't mean they're not engaging or doesn't mean they're not benefiting from the learning experience. It's just their route, particularly for them, is the way they've chosen to do it. So I'm not overly concerned if they don't come into the lecture. When the weather was really bad, not this time but last year, 2 years ago, I was actually doing live interaction because I couldn't get in. And I hate missing a lecture, so we were just through the discussion boards, etc., having live discussions with students. So, no, I'm not too concerned by that. But I'll come back to part of that shortly. Yeah, and that's a game of times. People used to say, you know, all those sort of things that I've done, quite expensive to get off the ground, take a long time. Are they benefiting the students? Well, yes, I think they are, but not in a quantifiable way. I can't say exam results have improved. What I can say is that we enrich their learning environment. And by doing that, by engaging them, it feeds into retention. Okay, well, we'll have a look at some figures. The other thing about using Blackboard, I don't know how many people use that, but you can actually have an early indication of students aren't engaging. So in our first week, we can see that students haven't logged on. And this caused me to, shall we say, develop a robust pastoral care system. And what I mean by that is they would get a phone call within the first week if they hadn't logged on. And invariably, it was enrolment problems, problems with the finances, or occasionally technological problems. And we could resolve that virtually straight away. And it also meant the students had somebody that they could trust because they got a person talking to them, sorting a problem out, and they come back to you in future. So we actually actively ring our students up now at least once a term. I can't always do it myself, but we've got some administrators that help out. And I thought this might be intrusive, but the students really, really enjoy it and they feel part of a community. So there's a whole package of things that we're doing. And we get feedback through staff-student exchange committees. I hold a technology evening once a year and through sort of course module questionnaires. And the thing is, if you're asking students for input, you have to feed back to them what's been done with that input. So, you know, some students wanted audio casts. And I said, well, I wasn't sure it would work, but we tried it, did it as an experiment, failed. Well, it didn't fail, there just wasn't a great uptake on it. So we fed it back to them and they were quite happy. So as long as if you're raising their expectations, you've got to either deliver or give them reasons. Just to show you briefly what's happened in our department, I said we were in crisis back in the late 80s, 90s. These are recruitment figures for all students in our department. And you can see, latterly, we're enjoying quite a rise in student numbers. This is looking at retention. And although we've provided all this material for our students, you can see clearly we've got an increasing dropout rate up to 2007-2008. And that's where I started looking at the problem. Why is this happening? They've got all this wonderful material. At that time, we were providing it on CDs. We didn't have Blackboard. So in 2008-2009, we introduced Blackboard. We introduced videos of the lectures. We introduced my robust pastoral care system. And that package has given us some fantastic retention figures. That's not that. That's purely for first-year undergraduates, that. The blue is the same, first-year undergraduates drop out, and the red is for all years. Okay, so it doesn't just affect the first years, that provision. So we're quite lucky at the moment in terms of boasting very good retention figures. I think over the sector in general, there's been a lot of effort made to improve retention, so I don't think we're alone in bringing these down.
Is there any other variable that could be involved?
I'm sure there is, but none that we've identified, should we say. Just, that's my let-out clause. When I put in for an application for some money, I was told that they couldn't see a causal link with our improved retention. So, you know.
So you don't think that increased fees, for instance, may have something to do with
it? Our fees have just generally been fairly stable. They've crept up a little bit, but they haven't been a major problem. I think they will become a major problem in 2012, and I think we will lose a lot of our leisure learners. But we'll see. That's an unknown at the moment.
Are you asking any more or any less in terms of prior qualifications?
No. No. That's pretty stable. Sometimes people coming back into education when they've retired haven't, their formal qualifications are years old, and you know, we're looking for enthusiasm, commitment. Because if I tell you, with the best will in the world, you might love geology, but can you really come in to us 3 nights a week? Because that's what it takes. Ooh, I'm running out of time. Sorry, I told you I'd do this. So yeah, there are issues to be addressed, I think. Okay. Let's just go through this pretty quickly. So really, our teaching methods and styles haven't changed dramatically, but our delivery has, and it's having a huge impact for our students and for us. I like this quote. It is from sort of Diana Lorillard. Begin with an ambition, use technology to achieve it. So I think when you review the technology available and what you're trying to achieve, that's important. I just want to talk about the future, because we've mentioned it all throughout the day. And I think the biggest growth area is going to be this mobile learning. Do we need to physically come into university? I know the University of Highlands and Islands are dealing with this on a large scale, rather than having traditional places to come into. The Martini effect. Any place, any time, anywhere. So I think, you know, this is the casualisation of learning, or just increasing flexibility for that learning? Yeah, that's quite a nice quote. So nothing fundamental has changed, even with all this technological wizardry. I'll leave you to think about that one. I think mobile learning, the social networking sites, the Facebook, the Twitter, I haven't got my head around how that can be used in an academic way. I can see it in the sort of social cultural side of coming into university, etc., but I'm not sure yet about that. But YouTube, we've got a YouTube channel, and certainly has generated some interest. And because those videos are available, people are sort of looking at our site. So it's a bit like Russell was saying, a marketing tool as well.
When you do your lectures online, are they very short 20-minute things or full 1 hour?
Yeah, full 1 hour ones. Mm. Yeah. If I had time, I'd break them down for the students, but... okay. Yeah. Just, I don't know about this. Think of smartphones. I don't know, have many people got these smartphones? Some mixture. I never had one until, well, it's not even a smartphone. I had a I didn't have any really advanced technology. I just had a mobile phone, emergencies only, that sort of thing. And then I was developing these mobile videos, and I kept having to borrow somebody's iPod. So this chap said, right, there you go, present for you, Stephen. I had an iPod Touch. That's great. I love it. It's the tactile interaction. I see my kids. They can't get off the things. And the interesting thing about this pinstripe docking rage, Boris Johnson's bikes around London, often you can't park your bikes, they're full. And this chap was going to be late for his meeting and he couldn't find anywhere to park. You can get apps on your smartphones to tell you where the nearest docking stations are, where they're free. So I think that level of interaction, people need sort of instant access to information these days. My son goes out in his car into London, doesn't take a map, takes his phone. I'm just going, no, take a map. Yeah. So I think, the other thing is, I haven't got time to do it now, but primary school kids who supposedly, I read this in the paper this morning, who download educational apps onto their smartphones are performing better. Primary school. So this is coming.
But again, with this, what we've got to try not to do is just recreate the traditional lecture through the mobile device. So
absolutely.
Just data delivery isn't necessarily about what mobile learning is. It's about social participation and interaction.
Right. Yeah. And part of my sort of wiki thing is the collaborative learning thing, and I think it's very important to bear that in mind. Okay, I'm going to stop there. You've all got evaluation forms, so could you quickly fill those in? I've been asked to get you to do that. I'm sorry. Sorry I've run out of time, but I hope you've enjoyed the presentation. If you've got any comments, you can always email me. But thank you for your participation. So at the end of the conference I did last year in our place, I asked people about what innovation they might like to use in their lecture. And they came up with wikis, blogs, all these types of things. But when asked about the barriers to implementing them, lack of time, lack of money, lack of resources, and lack of academic staff knowledge. And I still think that's pertinent to most of us today. And it comes back to
technical knowledge.
Yes.
Or rather than academic.
Yeah.
The technology itself is
another. Well, where are we going to be in 2 or 3 years' time? It's changing so fast. And whether we should always engage with that, I'm not sure. Maybe some of this needs to be embedded and used. And that's the driving force for us uptaking it, I don't know.
Just as an example, student feedback from a mobile learning project I've been involved in. One of the students put on the feedback form, oh my God, they now expect us to buy a PDA to complete the course, which of course we didn't, but there are those traditional access issues.
Well, some of the research has shown that although most students have got very good smartphones, they find it an intrusion if the institution is contacting them through their phones. Yeah.
But they're happy to use their phones in our lectures.
I know. It's strange, isn't it? A strange relationship. Yeah.
I don't feel sorry about using their phones for academic stuff because they use it in the lectures and all over the place.
Yeah.
So
what are they using for in the lectures?
Booking cinema tickets.
I think they're sending texts to you something. This is really boring.
Or they're looking at the topic that you're talking about. That's where you'd like to believe.
Yeah. They're looking for online resources. So thank you very much for attending this seminar. I've enjoyed talking to you. I hope you've got some inspiration from it as well. As I said, any questions or ideas, I'll be happy to receive. And I hope you've enjoyed the conference. It's been very good. Thank you all.
Thank you.